such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
Hey, welcome everyone. God bless you for tuning into The Winds of Change. Father Tom Coys here with another brain-wrinkling hour, and I do believe I will brain wrinkle your brain because my brain is wrinkled.
Wow.
I'm certainly trying to make sense.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Yeah, I'm trying to make sense of everything that's going on, and it's not so easy, my friends. That's why we need shows like The Winds of Change. That's why you need to check in on your good news sources that are not filtered by a fear of Catholicism.
I'll put it that way. We're going to need a bigger boat.
We're going to need a bigger hour. Maybe see if we can get 3 hours today, Nick. Wouldn't that be possible for so? Well, God bless you for spending 1 hour. And whether you're listening live on a Wednesday afternoon at noon or you're listening on a podcast, which, to be perfectly honest, is how I listen to many radio shows and podcasts, is at my times. Not when they're being live, but when I have the time. I actually have a job, and I need to take care of business, as most of you do, I'm sure. So we try to squeeze in. As a matter of fact, those of us who like are news junkies of sorts, we have a little phrase that we sometimes use called catching up on blogs. It's kind of like catching up on your reading, right? Which that's another important thing to do. And at times, it's a formidable task. Also, we have to catch up on our prayers, right? And those take a priority. We have to do our prayers daily and get to Mass, right? Got to do those things. And hopefully, I pray that you're able to find a good place to do that, right? Good place in your house, a good place somewhere nearby. Could be the perfect bench in a forest preserve. It could be the perfect patio, outdoor deck, where you either catch up on your reading and your praying. So anyways, what I want to start off with is some great insights from one of my heroes, G.K. Chesterton. I'm enjoying his book called Catholicism and Converts, or Catholics and Converts. I forget the exact title of it. But anyways, especially because I think he has a sense of the word tradition that we need to appreciate in a deeper way today, because traditionalists and people who are fond of Catholic tradition all of a sudden are kind of being picked out or labeled as the problem. Actually, we even get that from words from Rome and different members of the hierarchy. There is a sense of those who appreciate tradition are the problem in the church today, and we have to get around that. So if you are a traditionalist, and you are a problem, let me help you. First of all, I like to take especially words from members of the hierarchy that seem to be wrongly directed at the wrong people. I delight in reminding you of something that Cardinal George used to say during many of our presbyteral meetings. He would say he came to Chicago, and it had the reputation of being a very liberal diocese, archdiocese, to be technical. And he would like to say to us priests gathered with him, he'd say, you know, I find the church here is very conservative. And he would smile with a little smirk, as it were, and say, you're all very conservative in the sense that you're afraid of change. You just want to keep the status quo, and therefore you're conservative. What he meant by that is that since Vatican II, there are a whole lot of changes and a whole lot of ways of doing church have gained the light of day, have gained popularity, have gained dominance, as it were, and the presbyterate especially had a particular propensity to maintain that new ground, that new methodology, and therefore some of the old-fashioned ways that were now in some ways new ways to people who have never heard of them before became a great threat. So if someone from the hierarchy is going to say that those traditional Catholics are a problem, I will join and say, cheerio. You know, you're absolutely right. Those people that just want to maintain the status quo of abortion rights are certainly part of the problem. Those who want
you
to...
You just wrinkle my brain, man.
Yeah, that's a good brain wrinkler. Those in the church who are very strongly committed to conserving the new tradition of the use of artificial contraception in marital relations are definitely part of the problem. Those who are maintaining the new tradition that you have to be open and tolerant of those who have promoted and are praising different perverted senses of human sexuality. Those are the traditionalists that are really a danger to the church today. So if you're accused, if you sense that you are a person that likes a lot of the Catholic tradition, and you're accused of being part of the problem, I encourage you to say, oh yes, those traditionalists that are conserving and doing almost everything they can to conserve abortion rights, let us say, and or the new kind of irrelevance of a theological doctrine. You could use a few of those examples. The abortion issue will suffice if you are discussing with somebody their disdain for traditionalists. I find it in one sense very true, and in another sense very difficult for the person to respond against, you know, or respond to. There is abortion rights have been established as the tradition of the new modern world. So those who are against that tradition can't be called traditionalists. We might like some different forms of prayer. We might like a kind of reverence that
reminds one of days gone by, but certainly we're not going to be traditionalists in the sense that we're going to help maintain the new traditions of Roe versus Wade as it is. That's the sad one of the worst things that the new man in the White House has done is he says he wants to codify Roe versus Wade throughout the 50 states, and that saying that he wants to codify it is to remove one of the longtime strategies of pro-life people, and that is to get the Supreme Court to rescind its declaration, which wouldn't make abortion legal throughout the land. All it would do is kick it back to the states and then let the states fight about it. Then, of course, certain states would most likely pass some laws to protect life and close the abortion clinics, as it were. Of course, that will set a lot of folks upset, and we'll say, no, you can't do that. We need a law for all 50 states. States can't do that. In a lot of ways, it's sad to say that we are living through a new kind of civil war. When I wrote my book, The Ashes That Still Remain, this is what I envisioned 25 years ago. And it's sadly becoming more and more of a reality in front of me, as it were, right? So here's something that Chesterton says regarding the concept of tradition. And again, we gotta be open to a new understanding of that word. He says, for them, meaning his Protestant friends, religion is tradition. Interesting. Religion is tradition. I grew up with this. I grew up with that. My grandfather was this. My mother, my father was this, and I'll be this, you know? And it has that ring of the same kind of thought process that goes with when you claim one political party over another, doesn't it? But Chesterton goes on, continues and says, a century or two from now, spiritualism may be a tradition, and socialism may be a tradition, and Christian Science may be a tradition. But Catholicism will not be a tradition. It will still be a nuisance and a new and dangerous thing. That's beautiful. He mentions spiritualism and socialism. We got to kind of translate the first one. Spiritualism is a kind of religion without faith without religion, I guess you can call it. And we hear that all the time. I believe in God, but I'm not religious. I want to be spiritual, but I don't want to be religious. So, and that was the case back in Chesterton's day too, which was not that long ago. And so he points out spiritualism a century from now. It might be a tradition, like in the sense that 400 years ago or 300 years ago, no religious people thought you could be spiritual without being religious. Religion was the incubator of spiritual things. And the opposite of religion was materialism. And therefore, when some people came around in the 18th century, 19th century, and said, I want to be a spiritualist without being religious, they created a new tradition. Socialism, too, he says. Now, tradition, socialism may be a tradition. In other words, I'm gonna join that tradition, socialistic tradition, because it's needed for today, and I will be a socialist because the times call for it, as it were. He's saying that he became Catholic because it wasn't tradition in that sense. Catholicism wasn't traditional in the sense that passing traditions are just that, passing traditions. He saw in so much that is not Catholic, in the political world and in the religious world, traditions that didn't want to say what Catholicism was saying, namely that these things are going to be true forever and everywhere. In other words, he saw in what most people will label as tradition, he saw fads. He saw not timeless traditions, but time-bound traditions, fads, popularity. And he found that if he's going to sink his teeth into a religion, he wants something that will rise above or be in contrast. He says it will still be a nuisance, as in Catholicism was a nuisance to the Anglicans of London. It was like something that would prick their conscience, obviously. And he said that he saw in Catholicism something new and dangerous, because it was ready to question the traditions. And that's where I'm saying I see a great parallel between the new traditions. I'll say it this way. The new Catholicisms of a Catholic like Biden, or Catholics like Father James Martin and his Jesuit confreres.
Wow.
That they have...
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Indeed, that is brain. They have established a new tradition. But Chesterton would say, if he were living today, that they are not the dangerous thing. They are the thing that is being welcomed and being touted as the comfortable thing, as it were. They're abandoning a form of faith that is dangerous. So he goes on, he says, the mark of the faith is not tradition in the sense of passing fads, but it is conversion. The mark of faith is conversion. It is the miracle by which men find truth in spite of tradition or passing fads, and often with the rendering of all the roots of humanity. So when true faith is discovered, as one discovers in Catholicism, it can possibly uproot a society, a whole nation, as it were. And he's obviously referring to England. And I want you, my listeners, since we're inhabiting the wonderful country of the United States of America, the roots of tradition with a capital T. This is what often in catechism is referred to. Tradition in the right sense is tradition with a capital T. Tradition as the passing fads is with a small T. And one can certainly prefer traditions of a sort with a small T to other traditions with a small T, as long as they don't contradict or come and try to tear down the traditions with a capital T. But you have to have that knowledge, or you have to have that sense of the difference. So let's continue here after a quick break. I want to continue with a couple more quotes from the good G.K. Chesterton, and then got to adventure into some other deep waters of the winds of change. You are listening to The Winds of Change. This is AM 750 WNDZ.
This Thursday, Father Anthony invites members of the sixth grade class of St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy, along with their teacher, Miss O'Reilly, to Winds of Change. Join us this Thursday at noon on AM 750 WNDZ.
Go Academy, and you're listening to The Winds of Change.
Here's some good news. We are pleased to announce that St. Stanislaus Kostka is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in answer to our Blessed Mother's call to open the doors. The Blessed Sacrament will again be exposed all day, every day, except when Masses or other services are being held. You are invited to come and pray anytime, day or night. For your safety, we ask that you practice social distancing and wear a mask. Hand sanitizer is available, and St. Stan's has increased cleaning and sanitizing of the church, and a security person will be on site. More information can be found at ststanschurch.org. That's ststanschurch.org. St. Stanislaus Kostka is located 2 blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway.
Here's good news about a great school with in-person instruction for your child.
Father Anthony is asking you to send your children to St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy for in-person instruction. Excellence in educating the mind, heart, soul, and spirit of each student. Cost should not be an obstacle to enrolling your child at St. Stan's Academy. We have scholarships and financial aid available to fit all budgets. Everyone who wants to give their child a Catholic education can do so at St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy. Faith, virtue, honor. St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy is an elementary school offering grades pre-kindergarten to 8th grade and is located minutes from downtown Chicago. Call the school office at 773-278-4560. That's 773-278-4560. Or visit sdstanschicago.org for St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy.
Welcome back, everyone. God bless you for tuning into The Winds of Change on AM 750 here. Hope you can tune in well, or hope you can get to the podcast, right? If you know how to work a computer, almost all computers will have a app that where you can listen to podcasts and radio shows and what have you. Go to Podbean. Our podcast is hosted by us. A company called Podbean. If you go into Podbean, you could find the Winds of Change show. You got to put in the Winds of Change show to find Father Bush and all of us compatriots of his that do the show Monday through Friday, right? Anyways, I'm trying to tackle the importance of having the right sense of what tradition means in order to help us through. I think it's important because some very significant people in the church today are pointing out Catholics who like to consider themselves traditional are being called the problem in the church today. We got to get rid of those kind of Catholics. So we have what will we have then? The obvious response by those people who are saying this would be, well, we need liberal Catholics, not traditional Catholics, and then we'll be able to save and grow the church. It's a funny thing. I have to share this before I get to another Chesterton quote. We were talking about trying to grow our churches, get more people in the pews, with some people that were really behind a certain program that is designed to get people back in the church. And one of the keys of that program, one of the elements of that program was touted as being what was labeled radical hospitality. When you are radically hospitable, you will grow the church. You will get more people in the pews. I had to raise the question because I know this is sort of an upgrade of what I used to hear quite a bit, and I've never really raised an objection to hospitality. I've always thought we have to be hospitable. As a matter of fact, I sort of smile and I joke with people that I meet at the church and at our different events and what have you. And if they're new, I always try to get them to think about joining our church, our parish, our mission. when they say something, well, I belong to this church or I belong to that church, and I sometimes will say, well, you know, we're in an era today where you could be a dual citizen, right? We know a lot of people who have dual citizenship. I know many Irish people that are still citizens in Ireland and citizens of the United States. I know a number of people who are dual citizens of Mexico and the United States, Italy and the United States, Israel and the United States. There's a lot of people that are dual citizenships of these two countries, two different countries, and they have to try to split their loyalty and to either one. They vote, and maybe they even pay taxes. I'm not even sure about that in some ways. But I'll sometimes say, oh, well, you can be a Catholic with dual parishionership. It's not the best, or it's not, we have different reasons for that. Some people may have children in school in one way or another. It could be a distance issue, more convenient, etc. You belong to this club or that club, but you find yourself drawn to two different Catholic parishes. So I say you could be a Catholic with dual citizenship. but then I add too, I like to add, but we do have a strict rule here at St. James's, where I hail from. I say, we have a strict rule here. What's that? I say, we only allow nice people in church. They always get a laugh out of that because they say, oh, well, I'm a nice person. And I say, you seem to be a very nice person. So anyways, I share that with you because I want you to know that I believe in hospitality. But I had to raise a question.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
As we spoke about the new evangelization and how to get people into church and fill up the pews more, I had to raise a question. I said, you know, I have a little difficulty with the term radical hospitality. And I was questioned, what do you mean by that? How can you have a problem with radically welcoming people into the church? And I just simply said, because there's some people I don't want in my church. And they found that very, very crazy. I think, though, that if they found me saying that crazy, they would have to admit that they believe the same thing. There are some people they don't want in their church. And especially if I were to keep drawing the analogy, if it was a very, shall we say, liberal-minded Catholic, they would not want conservative-minded Catholics in their church. But even more than that, and I think you could, and I know we do have people that the distance between a liberal and a conservative is a fluctuating needle, shall we say. You know, there's some people that would say, oh, I'm a conservative on this point, I'm a liberal on that point. It's not a binary thing, to use the popular word today, binary. People don't, that word is used to refer to the two sexes of the human race. Well, we don't want to look at sexuality as binary. We don't want to think that there's only two genders. It has to be a fluid thing. Now, on that, I would say, no, that is a binary thing. It's not a fluctuating needle. But in many ways, being liberal and conservative is a bit of a fluctuating needle on that scale between the two sides. However, there are people, and I'm sure you've met them, that are bad for your community. There are people that are not going to be tolerant of those who are principled on certain matters, shall we say. I have to raise the issue because it does come up. If someone
is principled on the matter of marriage and the idea that two gay people cannot come across or cannot promote their relationship as on par with marriage between a man and a woman, they do become very intolerant of those who would say what you're doing is a sin or what you're doing is not a sacrament, not a marriage. It's a perversion of what God has intended for man and woman, etc. So when I question the idea of hospitality, and I just said, because there's some people that I don't want in my church, I was looked at as a person with three heads, but I really want all those people who would defend radical hospitality as also having three heads, because if you're honest, you will also say, there are some people that I don't want in our church. We got to weed out the intolerant, for instance, they will say. We have to weed out those who are not going to dialogue. We are going to weed out those who calling for more traditional forms of worship, for instance. Okay, so anyways, that's part of what, why and how the very term tradition is a bit of a mystery, and it's not as obvious as you might think. And Chesterton, in his Conversion, is pointing out this very, very powerful notion of tradition as the bad form of tradition is fads, passing traditions. And he sees Catholicism as that kind of tradition that doesn't render the idea of passing traditions. And it, from the get-go and through the 2,000 years of history, it has been what it is. It often becomes a thorn in the side of societies. It's ready and willing and able to make people question. It's that constant pricking of one of the conscience, you know, and that's why Catholicism has that reputation, and it's often used in a very pejorative sense as Catholic guilt. And there, since the 60s and 70s, some Catholics have become very happy to have found a form of Catholicism that doesn't disturb their conscience. Now it could be that they have no sin, but that, of course, is a really bold statement. And even the holiest of holy, saintly people won't go that far. They'll say, "Yeah, my pursuit of God, my pursuit of Jesus, my pursuit of being Catholic." Often does disturb my conscience. That's how I grow. That's how I become better. And so here, let's go to another one of these quotes from Chesterton in his book, Catholics and Converts. He says, as he reflects on his conversion, "There was this in common between the Catholics to whom I have come after his conversion and the liberals among whom I was born." He calls liberals all those, even the Protestant, mostly Anglican Protestants of his youth and all. He says this, that there's something in common. Neither of them would ever have imagined for a moment that patriotism was enough. Now, there's a very powerful thought. Neither the traditional-minded Catholic nor the liberal-minded Protestant, or liberal-minded Catholic, for that matter, we all would say it's not enough just to be patriotic.
although I think there are some, even in the Make America Great Again movement, who might say or who miss this point. As long as you are fervently patriotic, you will be advancing the cause of Christ and his dictates, his admonitions to the world. But I don't sense that often in even the MAGA crowd, those who want to make America great again. When President Trump said, "I want to put America first," he's not saying that getting America back on its feet again and creating a kind of strong America, what have you, a prosperous America. He was humble enough to realize that that wasn't recreating Christianity. He was humble enough to say, well, every country should put their country first. And he was sort of laying the ground for Catholicism to come in and water each and every country's patriotic feeling. Yes, you have to put your country first, but faith then comes in and unites the various nationalities to a higher loyalty, as it were, which would kick in when conflicts come between nations, i.e. war is on the horizon. And so you would have to consult your higher form of loyalty in order to deal with the conflicts between nations, as it were. And this is certainly lost on a lot of folks today. I want to continue this bit of a quote, and I still want to get to a very powerful things about the presentation, which we just had the other day. A couple things that Archbishop Vigano has said. And let's take another break. I am Father Tom Coy, sitting in for Father Anthony Bush. You are listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
This Thursday, Father Anthony invites members of the 6th grade class of St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy, along with their teacher, Miss O'Reilly, to Winds of Change. Join us this Thursday at noon on AM 750 WNDZ.
We are the students of St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy, and you're listening to the Winds of Change.
How long has it been since you have been to church? Busy schedule? Work, or just lost interest? To be Catholic is not just merely attending Mass as just another weekend activity to be checked off the to-do list. Participation in the sacred liturgy gives you the opportunity to be intimately connected to Christ through the Holy Eucharist. You can also cleanse yourself of sin through the sacrament of reconciliation as a baptized Catholic. Come before the iconic monstrance to be in Christ's presence in the sacred silence of the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, St. Stanislaus Kostka Church. Is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. St. Stan's is just off the Kennedy, 2 blocks north of Division on Noble. Come back to Christ through the sacred liturgy and his gift of the sacraments at St. Stan's.
Here's good news about a great school with in-person instruction for your child. Father Anthony is asking you to send your children to St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy for in-person instruction. St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy offers excellence by educating the mind, heart, and spirit of your child with faith, virtue, and honor. Cost should not be an obstacle to enrolling your child at St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy. We have scholarships and financial aid available to fit all budgets. Anyone who wants to give their child a Catholic education can do so at St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy. St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy is an elementary school offering grades pre-kindergarten through 8th grade and is located minutes from downtown Chicago, 1 block north of Division, on Noble, just off the Kennedy. Call the school office at 773-278-4560. That's 773-278-4560. Or visit ststanschicago.org. St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. playing with the idea and the concept of tradition and how it's used in a lot of wrong ways, and how important it is to have a sense of what us Catholics mean by tradition with a capital T versus tradition with a small t. And I'm using G.K. Chesterton's beautiful work, Catholics and Converts, or Converts and Catholicism. I should get the name of that book exactly right. Sorry about that. If you Google it, I'm sure the right title would come up. Anyways, I'm reading some selections from it, because he's pointing out how it was his appreciation of the Catholic Church as it taught the unchanging truth is what attracted him and helped him see that churches that are just promoting changing traditions, something that's good for now, but in a generation or two, or certainly a century or two, will be way off the scale. And so it is. So anyways, he goes on to say, the most careless and cynical of Catholics knows that patriotism isn't enough. And so did most vague and visionary universalists. They were the universalists are the ones who are shooting for what you get echoes of in the, even in papal documents, of a form of religion that is for everyone, in the sense, not in the sense that a truth is true for everyone, but in a sense of it lacks the kinds of truth that people will resist. In other words, a kind of religion that everyone can buy into no matter what they believe. That was the universalists were those who taught that in Chesterton's time, and now I could say globalists are doing it now. And as I say, even some of the things coming out of the Vatican seem to promote that kind of vision. He says, of all the Protestant difficulties, which I here find it hard to imagine, this is perhaps the most common and in many ways commendable. The fact that the normal British subject begins by being so very British. The tradition I heard in my youth, the two simple truths inherited from Priestley and Montaigneau, now two meaning two simple truths as T-O-O, not two as in T-W-O, the simpleton kind of truths that Priestley, you may not know that name, but Reverend Priestley was the founder of Universalism, which was very anti-Trinitarian. He figured Christians should be able to be Christian without believing in the Trinity. That causes too much trouble, obviously, because if you didn't push the divinity of Christ, you can get along quite well with Jewish people or Muslim people. So you could admire Jesus, but as you push the idea that he was divine, that's where you're going to get into trouble, as is today, of course. These simpleton kind of truths had in them something of that grand generalization upon which, as men, which in this first of those great figures, namely Priestley, face the howling jingoism of the French wars and deified even the legend of Trafalgar. Let me stop there for a second. He's using words that we wouldn't be familiar with. Chesterton is saying that the people who were the universalists, who wanted a religion that was not burdened by doctrine, I guess you could say, not an institution that would hurt people's consciences or be a kind of source of guilt. He says that they were facing howling jingoism. Jingoes
were a nickname for the British people who were what we would probably call today war hawks. They were always wanting to go to war to prove British superiority. They were the fighters. They can recall and remember great British victories. And so they were happy about those. Any kind of person who's patriotic can and should be happy about wars that your nation fought and won, right? And he mentions the French wars. Unfortunately, there were some wars between Britain and France where Britain won, but there were also wars between Britain and France that France won. So he mentions, even in the French Revolution or the U.S.-United States Civil War, Britain was rooting for the South during our American Civil War. And there were probably some jingoes, British people who said, let's go and join that war. But of course, Britain didn't come in. There was big effort on the part of America to keep Britain out of the war. If you watch some of those great Civil War movies, you'll see that you'll find British journalists and British soldiers, British diplomats. They were able to embed themselves in the Confederate army, but not in the Union army, because Britain was cheering for the South. Why was Britain cheering for the South so much? Not so much because they loved slavery. After all, Britain was outlawing slavery before the United States. The whole song "Amazing Grace" is based on the big fight. The song "Amazing Grace" was written by a British captain of a slave ship, and he saw the errors of his way. So that's an amazing, powerful story. But nonetheless, Britain was hoping that the Confederacy would win, primarily because if the South would have won, that would have meant Abraham Lincoln would have lost. Abraham Lincoln was primarily trying to promote the idea that a republic can and should prevail. And of course, Britain was not a republic. It's a monarchy, and still is, actually. So any nation that was in favor and thought having a king was the right form of political strategy for a society wouldn't have wanted Abraham Lincoln and his love for the monarchy to succeed, his love for the republic to succeed. This is by the way, I'm going to throw out a crazy idea here. And those of you who know me and those of you who may bump into me somewhere along the line, this is one of the things that I might have to discuss with one of my favorite guys today, Tim Gordon. Tim Gordon has said on a number of occasions he was not an Abraham Lincoln fan. And I could see why he says that, because he wasn't Abraham Lincoln obviously abandoned he didn't embrace Catholicism. But I do think Lincoln can and should be commended for his belief in the Republic. And as we can see now, the fight for and the push for doing away with the Electoral College, which means the big states and the small states the big states can't run roughshod over the small states. That's basically it. And what Joe Biden and his cohort are trying to eliminate the Electoral College, which is really, in essence, a sense of toppling the monarch, toppling the republic. In this case, not necessarily replacing it right away with the monarch, but replacing it with democracy, in the sense that
everyone should vote, and everyone's vote and everyone's idea of what can and should happen for the society has equal status. The problem with that is if you do away with the republic and the electoral college, you're not going to get what Plato and Aristotle believed was the true democracy, namely that everyone votes on everything. You're not going to get that. You're going to get everyone votes on the president. And in the republic, everyone votes for the president in the sense that they vote for electoral representatives who will vote in the electoral college. It's really a mysterious, foggy notion, but if I could say it well enough, I hope you could appreciate it. The classical form of democracy, which is what they think they're promoting when they're tearing down the electoral college, the classical form, as in Plato and Aristotle, is that everyone, as I said, votes for everything. I, for one, am not in favor of that because I don't want to vote. I don't want to be taking my. I have more things to do with my time. It's kind of like the beauty of the division of labor. When there's a bridge to be built across the Ohio River down in southern Illinois, I don't want to have to vote for that. Then when there's a new policy on electrical wiring that ComEd has to deal with, I don't want to have to vote for that. Obviously, there's a thousand things that can happen every day that our elected officials deal with that I don't want to have to deal with. If I were to have to deal with those, I wouldn't have enough time in the day to do my other work, as most of you wouldn't. And so that's part of the beauty of being in a republic. You elect people that you trust, who you think have the right stuff to make all those decisions day by day. So we're not the pure form of a democracy is really a challenge.
Wow.
It's really a difficult thing.
You just wrinkled my brain,
so,
man.
Yeah, it's brain wrinkling. Let me finish up here with Chesterton again as he talks about. He says, "The tradition I heard in my youth, the simple, two simple truths inherited from Priestley, they were facing howling jingoism, the warlike Brits who always wanted to prove that Britain was the strongest nation in the world, and therefore we got to keep on getting into wars that we will win." He says they even deified the legend of Trafalgar. Trafalgar was, of course, a famous naval battle back in 1803, right at the beginning of the French Revolution, actually. It stopped the united navies of Spain and France from attacking England. Obviously, a good British citizen who is proud of their nation, a patriotic British person, would love the Battle of Trafalgar because it was a great naval battle that Britain won. It reminds you a bit of like our attitude toward 9/11. Of course, we were attacked. We could say we lost the Battle of 9/11, but we are proud to fight in the battle against jihadist Islam, and that you can and should be proud of that. But you know that sense of winning wars doesn't equal true faith in Christ. It's not true Christianity. It's not true Catholicism. There's things that have to go beyond that
yes, there were definitely reasons for fighting those battles, and you can certainly appreciate them, but you're not going to identify the fullness of the faith with those, with what they were fighting, because there's a lot of things to fight. And so that's why, you know, soldiers who are in a war will maybe sympathize with the soldiers on the other side. They're not the ones calling the shots like the generals and the politicians are, but the soldier on the ground may truly sympathize with the soldier he has to fight, because there's other things to consider than what the war is about, and they're willing to do what they have to do, but they would realize that to be united in Christ would if they were fully united in Christ, they would not have to be facing each other on a battlefield. Like the class, the very famous stories of, I know in World War I, and they may have been in World War II, but especially the Christmas Eve truces that happened, where soldiers from France and soldiers from Germany stopped fighting on Christmas Eve, got out of their trenches, and sang Christmas songs together. That sense that patriotism isn't enough to capture the fullness of what we mean by the fullness of the faith. So anyways, Higa says, it is to that tradition that I owe the fact, whether it be an advantage or a disadvantage, that I cannot worthily analyze the very heroic virtues of a Plymouth brother whose only center is Plymouth. Plymouth, of course, not the car make that we know of here in the United States, and not only the pilgrims that came to the shores of America, but Plymouth being a town in England where the Puritans were centered. So a Puritan would be very British, and they would hold on to certain traditions of the Puritans. But Chesterton is saying that they're too centered on the Britishness of the Puritans. And they eventually found themselves cast away because they were promoting that their form of religion was the only religion that could really work in England, and the rest of the British were saying, no, you got that wrong. We want to celebrate Christmas, and we like our wine and cheese parties. Anyways, so for that nationalism, defective as it was, began long ago in the same central civilization in which the church herself began. If it has ended in the church, it began long ago in the Republic. And here he's referring to the Roman Republic, the Roman Empire, the pagan Roman Empire. In a world where all these flags and frontiers were unknown, where all these state establishments and national sects were unthinkable, a vast cosmopolitan cosmos that had never heard the name of England or conceived the image of a kingdom separate and at war, in that vast pagan peace which was the matrix of all these mysteries, which had forgotten the free cities and not dreamed of the smallest nationalities, which knew only humanity, the humanus genus, and the name of Rome. Nationalism is admirable. After all, the religion that taught the world that nationalism isn't enough was incubated in the rich spirit of the love of the Roman Empire. For indeed, that wise religion was kept in its own name, its noble spirit, for we are called Roman Catholics. Precious. I'm Father Tom Coyes. You've been listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deep for truth or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? Marvel and flash. much meaning.